and the walk-up line, and then we load the cars for about an hour and a half, 2 hours. Then we clean up everything and go about to the...
This is 90.7 FM WGXCA, Hudson Catskill, the station that everyone loves.
Wave Farm programs are made possible in part by the New York State Council on the Arts, with the support of Governor Andrew Cuomo and the New York State Legislature, the National Endowment for the Arts, the Greene County Legislature through the County Initiative Program administered by CREATE, the Alexander and Marjorie Hoover Foundation, the Teabacker Fund, the Joseph Family Charitable Trust, and hundreds of other generous individual donors, including WGXE sustaining supporters, who provide critical monthly support. Thank you.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Fridman Gallery in New York, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about Creative Community Radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
WGXC 90.7 FM, Aqua, Catskill, Hudson, New York 90.7 FM. Listeners reported. It's radio for open ears, open heart, open hands, and open mind. We give thanks again to you for supporting WGXC all through the years, and I hope that you stay with us.
Hello, Opera. Hello, Upper Hudson Valley. Welcome to Tech Talk, where your questions about consumer electronics are answered. The answers may be right, the answers may be wrong, but they are at least answers. So give us a call here at WGXC 518-622-2598. This is Ralph of the Ralph and Bill duo, and I seem to be flying solo today, which is just fine because I am the actually smart and witty one. So hello, Mid-Hudson Valley, Upper Hudson Valley, and hello all listeners of WGXC in New York and through the World Wide Web all over the world. How are you all doing? We've had another interesting week in tech as well as everything else. There was a fascinating article in Slate that was headlined "Facebook kowtowed to conservatives and got nothing in return." And I am a conservative, and I am embarrassed to say that this is probably true. The conservatives have had their hatchets out for Facebook for reasons that I don't really fully understand. But the fact is that Mark Zuckerberg has been standing up for civic dialogue on the internet. And I think he's really shown a lot of integrity with the way they patrol against hate speech, but they're very tolerant of varying ideologies. So Facebook has managed to make itself hated for reasons that I don't understand, since I myself like it. And since Bill and I have a Facebook site called the Capitalist Manifesto, or the Capitalist League, that has managed to attract in less than a year almost 150,000, I think it's 149,500 followers. That's, the Capitalist Manifesto is very conservative, and Facebook has never once given us a hard time. They are against hate speech at Facebook, but they are absolutely tolerant of ideological diversity. I give them props for that. And if any of you are have Facebook accounts, Facebook has 2.7 billion active users, so it would be surprising if you do not. then you should check it out and let your voice be heard. Now, it seems to me that we have a caller, Wendy from New Rochelle, and I'm hoping that Wendy from New Rochelle has a great question that's not too hard, because Bill, who's here to answer the hard questions, is not here at the moment. And so I hope this is a softball. Wendy from New Rochelle, bring it on.
Okay. It seems that my iPhone won't hold a charge.
Hello,
should I buy
Wendy from New Rochelle. Are you muted?
Am I muted? No.
Oh, good. We can now hear you.
Okay.
And I just want to, I want you to know that a mime is a terrible thing to waste. So we are really, really glad, since this is radio, that we hear your voice.
Okay.
Hello, Wendy from New Rochelle. What is your question?
My iPhone won't hold a charge. Should I buy a new battery or buy a new iPhone?
That's a very good question. So let's start here. What kind of what vintage iPhone do you have?
It's a 7S.
Okay, well, I have a 6S, so we are sort of quantumly entangled there, because both of our iPhones go back a long time. I don't know whether it's 5 years, but it's many generations ago. We're now up to iPhone 12.
So okay.
That is five iterations from your version and six from me. So I have to ask you a couple of questions, based upon your answers, I'm going to try to successfully answer your question. So let's start here. How long does your battery last when you're not plugged in?
It definitely lasts through the day.
Okay, and does that meet your needs? I mean, is your concern...
If I was wanting to make a call or speaking later in the night, it won't hold. I mean, it's gone.
Meaning you would have to plug it in order to make calls.
Yeah, right.
Okay, well, let's cross-examine you here, Wendy from New Rochelle. Are you plugged in now?
No, I'm not.
But it's nighttime in New Rochelle.
No, I'm talking about later, not 7:07.
Oh, okay, good. Okay, well, you have a number of options here, and it's a judgment call. So here are your three options that I'm aware of. Option number one is you can take your phone into a Staples, if there's a Staples nearby you. And last, when I did this, which was almost a year ago, they would actually sell and install a brand new battery for you for $29. Apple was trying to make up for the fact that this was a deficiency in their product, and so they were providing new batteries plus installation at a very affordable price. And I did that, and it's held me in good stead. Although, frankly, now my battery is beginning to weaken after as little as an hour or two. So that brings us to option number two, to your option number two. Option number two is you can buy a backup power supply. You can buy this in CVS or...
Yeah, I have one of those.
Okay, and you can... I have several of those. And you can simply carry with you a backup power supply and a charger wire, and then whenever your battery charge tends to run out, then you can just plug it into your backup power supply or supplies, and that actually works for me extremely well. And those backup power supplies are very inexpensive. $5, $10, $20. So that's option number one, is take it into Staples and get a new battery. And option number two is to get a backup power supply. And option number three is to go out and buy a new iPhone. And the new iPhone, the iPhone 12, You can go from anywhere from the Mini, which I believe I read somewhere is about $600 or $700. Mm-hmm. Or you can go to the iPhone, you know, Supreme. It has a slightly different name. And this has gotten rave reviews for the quality of its camera. And that will run you about $1,200, although I believe that if your provider is somebody like Verizon, and I don't know about AT&T or Sprint, but I assume it's the same for them, then you can roll that in and pay for that on a monthly basis without interest instead of paying the $1,200 charge up, the big money up front. So it depends. Now, that is obviously the most convenient. You don't have to deal with taking it into Staples and getting a new battery. You don't have to deal with the backup power supply. And plus, you get all of the excellent new features of the iPhone 12, particularly if you go for the iPhone 12, I think it's Pro, which will give you, according to all the reviews I've read on sites like Wired and Gizmodo, it will give you a really fantastic state-of-the-art camera system.
Okay.
If you use your camera a lot, then that's a very appealing. And if you're not price sensitive, that's a very appealing solution. But if you really, if the photographs you're already taking with your iPhone 7S are perfectly fine, I know the photos I take with my iPhone 6S are typically excellent. And would I like it to be better? Yes. Would I like it to be better $1,200 worth? No, I haven't gone down that road yet. But if you're not price sensitive and if you like taking pictures, great. Otherwise, I would recommend that you take your phone into Staples, find out if they still have the deal going for a fresh new battery, which by the way, will probably only last you 4 or 5 hours, not the kind of 10 or 12 hours that the iPhone 12 will last you. But if that meets your needs, then and you'd rather be frugal, do it that way. If money is not an object, then go out and treat yourself to an iPhone 12, either an iPhone 12 mini, or if you really want this spiffy camera, an iPhone 12 Pro.
Okay, sounds good.
What do you think about that?
I like it. I think I may go for that 12 Pro.
Well, thank you for calling in. And we have another caller coming in from, sounds like Carol from St. Louis, Missouri. Notice I pronounced it right. So Wendy from New Rochelle, thank you for calling in. We hope you'll call again for a future show. And if you'll hang up or let your battery run out now, time to usher in Carol from St. Louis. Hello, Carol from St. Louis. Are you there?
Hi, I got in first try. That's amazing.
That is amazing. That's a first.
Yes. Well, that's just me. I have a question about Microsoft Word.
Okay.
And I hold on. I have to turn my computer off here. I have to turn the sound off on the computer because it's kind of like, here we go.
That's just me. Hold on. I get that.
About Microsoft Word. Okay. Here's my question. I purchased Microsoft Word. I purchased two programs, one for myself and one for my husband's computer. And we successfully installed his. But when we bought it, we were told that we wouldn't have to be online in order to use the program. Well, now we come to find out that in order to get a new Word document and sometimes to find some documents that are on the computer already, you have to go back online, and he does not want his computer online. So is there a solution for that?
Well, things are all of computing is my the short answer is no. The longer answer is all of computing is migrating to what's called the cloud. And there that on the cloud, your data is held in a big complex of what's called servers, which are up to brutally and incorrectly oversimplify, are a bunch of hard drives, thousands of them, containing terabits of data. And frankly, Carol from St. Louis, I have all of my data on the cloud, and I'm not worried about it at all. I do not fear being subject to a compromising data breach. And whether or not you or your husband like it, the computing is very rapidly migrating to the point where our data is being held on the cloud, being held in these great big huge data farms, whether it's Amazon Web Services or whether it's Microsoft or whoever has it. And they charge you a very modest fee to store your data, something like $10 a month. And while I have heard about data breaches on the cloud, particularly embarrassing photos of celebrities, the chance there are so many terabits of data being held there, the chance that anything that comes from you or your husband being of actual interest to hackers is vanishingly small. So the bottom line is, Microsoft is one of the $5 trillion companies in the world. There's a reason for that. They're really good at what they do and providing the services that they provide. And they are, I find them admirable. I'm not disputing your husband's desire to keep his data secure on his own PC or on his own Mac, as the case may be. As the economists like to say, it's in Latin, and I don't speak Latin. I speak fluent Pig Latin, but it's something like de gustibus non disputandum. There is no arguing about matters of taste. And so if that's the way he wants it, he's entitled to that. Whether or not you care about your data being siloed inside your computer instead of being available and potentially vulnerable on the web, it's another story. So I'm sorry that somebody told you that. Look, I use Microsoft 365. It's software as a service. I don't really, it allows me, it provides me with Word, and it provides me with the other Microsoft services. I find it to be seamless, and I find it to be a spectacularly great value. That doesn't mean that you have to feel the same way about it.
There's a big downside to that, though, too, because if you're online, then you get all kinds of things coming in that you, and understand that when he's working on his computer, he can't be disturbed because of what he's doing on his computer. And it's, very discouraging to hear that we can't have a program that will work for him without being online.
I have not personally encountered this problem. And my techier than thou sidekick, Bill Collier, is absent without leave. He might have been able to provide you with more enlightenment than I can in terms of your ability to use Microsoft services while not being online. But so far as I'm concerned, you guys are stuck. And I just recommend that you go, if you could find your way through Microsoft tech support and get some guidance there. They might have a clever hack that I'm simply not sophisticated about, because this is not a problem that has occurred to me. But if that's not the case, then I'm guessing that there are probably other workarounds whereby your husband can actually access the software without being live online, but it might not be Microsoft.
Yeah, well, we've already paid for the program, and, installing it was not fun, but I managed it. I just feel like we're being held hostage, that's all. But
yeah, I hear you. Look, I empathize with you. I tend to be kind of
laid back about this, because these services that we are able to access online, whether it's Microsoft or Google or Amazon or Facebook, are really just so amazing to me. I am approaching my 70th year. And so all of the things that you can get online for either free or a absolutely trivial cost. I was in my youth, in my misspent youth, in the 1950s, yeah. 1960s, and 1970s, everything that we can do today on the web is so extraordinary as to have been beyond the imagination of science fiction writers of my childhood. And so really kind of grateful about what's available to us, and the drawbacks and the glitches, which are real, occur to be as trivial. But that doesn't mean they're trivial to you.
I've got two laptops to hook up with the web. I have mine online all the time, both of them. But it's just his personal preference, speaking of science fiction. But that's the way he is. Okay, well, I guess we'll just live with it, right?
Well, has he ever read any science fiction, Carol from St. Louis?
His name is Glenn Cook, and he's written an awful lot of...
Wait a minute, not Glenn Cook, the science fiction grandmaster.
Well, fantasy more than science fiction, but...
Right, the science fantasy grandmaster, the massive award-winning Glenn Cook. Wow,
yeah.
We are... So honored to have Mrs. Glenn Cook on our show.
Yep. Okay, well, I said he's just going to have to learn to live with it, right?
Well, that seems to be the case, unless you are, if you are as cunning as he is, if you are as cunning at Googling as he is about writing these massive science fantasy novels, award-winning, dominating the literature, then you might be able to find him a clever little hack on Google. If you do, be sure to come back and tell us all about it.
I'll let you know.
Thank you, Carol.
I'll let you know for future reference, okay?
Thank you, Carol Cook. Have a great evening.
Well, thank you for calling. I mean, for having me. Oh. Talk to you later.
Bye. Talk to you later. Okay, good. We have another call from somebody who... Let's see. Tom, you gotta up your game on the penmanship kind of thing. New caller, who are you, and where are you calling from?
Oh, I guess that's me. This is Blair. I'm calling from Enosburg Falls, Vermont.
Blair from Enosburg Falls, Vermont. That is. Just tell me. I'm just out of the blue. Okay. That is not where the world famous Quincy Hotel is, by any chance, is it?
It is, and I'm sitting here with the owner and developer Betsy Dorminy. I shouldn't have said that, probably, but right here.
Wait a minute, the world famous Betsy Dorminy, the inventor of the Quincy of the Crunchy Con meme.
The celebrated writer and
yes. Celebrated writer, her byline is seen all over the vast right-wing conspiracy new media. So we are really privileged tonight, from Mrs. Glenn Cook to Blair Dorminy. Welcome, Blair. What is your question?
Well, first of all, let me just say I'm delighted to be married to Betsy Dorminy. But my question, moving on, I have in my hand your book, which I'm just beginning to read, Redefining the Future of the Economy, Governance Blocks, and Economic Architecture. So I am also enthusiastic about blockchain technology and Bitcoin and various cryptocurrencies. And many of the skeptics are starting to catch on to this, including a lot of banks and so on. So my first question is, do you foresee a scenario in which some governments would begin to supplant Bitcoin with their own with their own crypto, and is that going to begin to would that affect the potential value of Bitcoin and other cryptocurrency if the United States and others get into the business of crypto?
Well, that's a very interesting question. Let me say this about that. First of all, I am a minor co-founder of a cryptocurrency stablecoin called Frax.finance. So, full disclosure, the mainnet has not gone live. It will be going live by the end of the year. I am a Bitcoin skeptic, but I am a stablecoin believer. And so the problem with the Bitcoin is that it is extraordinarily volatile in value. So we've seen it just this year go from something like $4,000 to something like $19,000, which in my personal view makes it into a speculative commodity, not a currency. It's certainly cryptic. You have encrypted data there. And for my more innocent listeners, Bitcoin was the initial version of something called a distributed ledger, in which data gets encrypted and then it gets stored on literally thousands, maybe tens of thousands of computers. So that, by virtue of its distribution, it makes it impossible, as a practical matter, to hack. Mm-hmm. And so it makes the record of the data immutable. That said, it's very inefficient because you've got the same data redundantly recorded on many thousands or even tens of thousands of computers, which just uses up a lot of electricity. The cryptocurrency uses up about as much electricity as Ireland. So that's one issue having to do with Bitcoin. The next issue is that the properties of moneyness, as set forth by William Jevons, the great economist, in the 1870s or so, are three. And that is, it's a unit of account, a standard of value, and a medium of exchange. As it happens, Bitcoin has failed all three properties. It is not a standard of, it is not a unit of account because its value fluctuates so wildly. And by the way, there are other altcoins, other kinds of cryptocurrencies that actually have gone up many, many times higher this year than Bitcoin has. The second thing is, it's not a store of value. It does have value, but the value fluctuates, and a store implies stability of value. And it is not really a medium of exchange because it takes so long to conduct a Bitcoin transaction that if you were to go into a convenience store or a bodega or the gift shop of the Quincy Hotel and try to buy something with Bitcoin, there would be a lag or a latency that would it could take, 15 or 30 minutes before the account settles. And you just don't want to hang around the store when you're going to buy a pack of gum and wait for half an hour while you're, after you've attempted to cash out for your account to settle. So not a unit of account, not a medium exchange, not a store of value. The stable coins out there are stable in value. So one Frax token is going to always be worth $1. And it's an algorithmic stable coin. And please don't ask me to go into the exotic details of that, as opposed to a fully collateralized stablecoin. But I do believe that once these stablecoins, which are the hottest thing right now in the cryptocurrency world, stabilize and prove themselves, that they will prove to be of enormous value.
to the economy. And I also believe that the central banks of the world will be very attracted to either creating their own CBDBs, CBDCs, central bank digital currencies, to augment but not to replace actual folding money. Or they will be interested in collaborating with companies like Frax.Finance, or maybe Facebook, which tried to create a stable coin about a year ago called Libra, and now they are coming back into the marketplace to having renamed their coin the Diem. I wrote a column criticizing Libra for attempting to stabilize against a basket of currencies, much like the IMF's special drawing rights, which I explained would just not work, because every time you walk into a store, your Libra would be stabilized against the dollar and the yen and a basket of currencies, but that would mean that it would bounce around against the dollar, and therefore you would never know whether your Libra was worth $1, or whether it was worth $1.05, or whether it was worth 95 cents, which would cripple it as a unit of account. Now, I'm sure they didn't read my column. I'm sure they just at Hacker Noon. I'm sure they figured this out for themselves. It doesn't take rocket science. And they've come out with this new stable coin called Diem that is going to be stabilized directly to the dollar. And there will be other Diems stabilized to the euro and the yen and so forth. And that might actually solve a great deal of defect in the original Libra. Plus, Facebook itself, which does not directly own the Libra Foundation, but it's influential in it. They have 2.7 billion active users, Facebook does. So that gives them enormous reach. It looks to me like they are going to be attempting to create Libra DM more like PayPal than like a digital currency. But they've developed a lot of animus among legislators, both in the United States and abroad, as well as among regulators. And so they have some pretty tough headwinds to negotiate in order to make Diem a standard and an appealing strategic partner for the Fed or any other central banks, the ECB, or the Asian central banks. And so I'm rambling here, Blair, from Enos Falls, Vermont, but I hope I'm sort of getting at your question, which is to say, yes, I believe that central banks are going to eventually embrace central bank digital currencies. Whether they do that in a way that supplants the private sector or collaborates with the private sector, it's too soon to tell.
May I ask a follow-up question?
Please, if you were not so totally disappointed with the answer to your first question, then
no,
please bring it up.
Not at all. I will say on behalf of Bitcoin, the bottoms seem to be getting higher, which is good if you care about it, and the adoption, or at least the PayPal's, I guess, embrace of Bitcoin will permit off-ledger transactions. So that kind of will deal with some of the slowness of Bitcoin transactions. Not everything has to be done on the ledger. That, you know, with a company as big as PayPal can have the positions taken, buying and selling, cancel out and settle that hash at the end of the day. But my two more questions, if I may. The one is, if you see deficiencies in Bitcoin, is there an alternative besides stable coin? Is there an alternative currency that you think addresses some of those deficiencies well? And then the next question is, do you foresee a role for blockchain technology in managing some of our problems with elections?
I'm sorry, managing some of our problems with elections?
Yeah, do you see a use for blockchain technology in attaining election integrity, do you see a way in which blockchain technology, because it's on the
ledger? The short answer is there is a blockchain company called, I think it's called Voters or Votes. I think it's called Voters, .com or .io. And frankly, I think that it is a badly over-engineered solution to a non-problem. So first of all, I personally don't think we have a problem with elections. I know there have been a lot of accusations presented particularly against mail-in voting in this pandemic era. All of these accusations have absolutely failed in every court, including the U.S. Supreme Court, 7-2, with all of the three justices appointed by Trump basically shutting down the argument. So I think that the election system, while imperfect, does a terrific job. And I actually think that the current voting machines that are being used, even though they're being attacked as somehow vulnerable to hacking and so forth, I also think that they do a very good job. And everybody, every judge that has looked at this, Bill Barr, the extremely loyal to Donald Trump attorney general who just stepped down today,
right.
Nobody has been able to find serious voter fraud en masse that would have invalidated the outcome of the election as reported. And by the way, I've written about this I'm a columnist for Newsmax. And I am a freelance writer elsewhere. To me, the right has a mythos of voter fraud, and the left has a mythos of voter suppression. And both of them have embraced the concept that there is some kind of really pernicious voter suppression on the part of the right. That's what progressives claim. And the conservatives, like myself, claim that there is, claim that there is a real problem with election integrity, for which I have not been. Look, I'm open to it. I just haven't been able to find any evidence that either one is factual. So the idea of using blockchain to solve this, what I consider to be a non-problem, strikes me as preposterous. And by the way, if it were a problem, there are other ways of using highly secure databases that do not require thousands of redundant versions of the data to be distributed across thousands of computers. There are far more efficient ways of recording votes than using blockchain to do that. So that is my highly opinionated and probably unpopular, if not outright wrong, opinion about using blockchain in the voting system. I think it's an over-engineered solution to a known problem.
Very well stated, and I agree with you. But thanks for that.
Yeah, but Blair, you had another question for me.
Well, no, the other question was, do you see, apart from the stable coins, do you see a cryptocurrency that you think addresses some of the deficiencies of Bitcoin in a way that would make you enthusiastic about it?
Well, the short answer is kind of. Enthusiastic is a little bit too strong. There's nothing wrong with our current monetary system. I take
I take great objection to the phrase fiat currency, because fiat is designed to be a little bit snarky and a little bit arbitrary. I've written and published hundreds of thousands of words on monetary policy and monetary economics at Forbes, at Newsmax, and freelance among at the American Spectator, and freelance among more venues than I could actually keep track of. And I prefer to use the phrase fiduciary currency. I myself am a well-known, in fact, I'm a notorious advocate of the classical gold standard as the gold standard of monetary mechanisms, the one that is the most efficient and the most equitable, and the one that is best for the working people, properly designed, as well as, for the economy at large. The dollar stayed worth a dollar from 1879 well into about the 1920s or 30s, and the dollar has now lost about 85% of its buying power since President Nixon closed, quote, temporarily, unquote, closed the gold window in 1971. And that has caused bouts of inflation and other forms of economic efficiency. I do not believe that Bitcoin or any cryptocurrency can rival gold for technical reasons. Gold has a wonderful many century, many millennium stock to flow ratio that makes it and by the way, it's industrially useless, so it is not particularly susceptible to fluctuations in demand depending upon the business cycle of boom and bust. So gold is kind of useless. It's pretty, and it's useless, which makes it extremely useful as a unit of account, particularly because for, I don't know, 2,000 years, 5,000 years, gold has increased in its above-ground monetary stock by about 1% to 2% a year, which allows an enormous stock to insulate against fluctuations. So it's really it really makes sense that the dollar, when it was defined by and convertible to a fixed rate of gold, remained impeccable in its buying power between 1787 and 1900 and beyond that. So that said, cryptocurrency has some wonderful qualities that are extremely good to settle transactions more efficiently than our current banking system or our current printed currency does. So, for instance, when you buy something using a credit card, it has to go through, I don't know, many invisible intermediaries, who each of whom take a little tiny piece of the pie. But at the end of the day, when you purchase something using a credit card, it takes about 3% that goes to those intermediaries to process the transaction. If we use cryptocurrency, we can probably bring that 3% processing, a series of processing fees, down very close to zero. And 3% may not sound like a lot, but when you buy something in a grocery store, a grocery store's gross profit margin tends to be around 3%. And they make their profits on the volume of transactions, but it's a very, very tight profit margin. So when the financial industry and the many intermediaries of the financial industry are taking 3% out of every transaction, that's a lot of money. I think it's over $150 billion a year of profits to them. I don't begrudge that, but the nature of capitalism is to come up with clever inventions that actually reduce the transaction costs, to come up with technologies that make things run more efficiently. And if we can keep that $150 billion in the pocket of the consumers, which is where we'll go if we can actually come up with a cryptocurrency that is easy to use and efficient and secure, as I'm hoping that a stable coin like the one I co-founded will actually successfully do. That is a good thing. And so I think that there is a role for cryptocurrencies going forward in the future. I think it's a significant role. I haven't seen anything that tells me that it is an existential or transformational role yet.
Well, thank you very much for your answer, and that's very interesting. I will look forward to reading your book.
Well, thank you. I write to be read, and by the way, I am the following co-author of the primary co-author, Dawn Talbot, who is exponentially more brilliant than I am. So hopefully we both bring value to the table in redefining the future of the economy. Governance blocks and economic architecture, if you really find it to be toe-curlingly brilliant, you should really give the credit to my lead co-author, Dawn Talbot. So thank you, Blair, and best wishes to the proprietor of the Quincy Hotel in Enosburg Falls, Vermont. And we now have yet another caller, Michael, from Portland, Maine. This is a very New England-y kind of day. Thank you for calling, Blair.
All right. Hello.
Hello, Michael from Portland, Maine.
Hello, Tech Talk. I have a fairly straightforward question. It was recently asked to Elon Musk, and his answer, I'll just start with what he said, was what's outside of the simulation, which was a wonderful Elon Musk answer. I loved it. It made me love him even more. So the question was, if we reach the point where
Michael from Portland, Maine, could you talk a little slower and a little louder? Because I'm making out about 70% of what you have to say, but to do you justice, I would really like to make out 100% of what you have to say.
Let me put my headphones in. 1 second. Okay, is that better?
Yes, but please talk a little louder and a little slower.
Okay, got it. So, AGI, AI that's intelligent, highly intelligent. Are you familiar with AGI?
AGI?
Artificial General Intelligence. It's what DeepMind is working on right now. It's the AI that you see in the movies where in Moon they talk to the computer gives an answer, and it's more like it's an ultra intelligent being, potentially hundreds of times more intelligent than a human.
Wait a second. Have you taken into account how intelligent I am when you make a claim like that?
Well, there's a few outliers. So the question is, if we get to the point where we create artificial general intelligence, this is what DeepMind and Google are working on together. This is what I'm sure many people around the world are working on publicly and in secret. If you get to that point, that's almost a singularity event. So if you had the opportunity to ask artificial general intelligence a question, let's say we reach that point, whether it's AIs who make the AGI or we make the AGI, but it's this thing with boundless intelligence, boundless abilities to answer questions. What would you ask it?
Well, let me turn that around. What would you ask it?
Well, I would ask the same question Elon Musk did, which is what's outside the simulation, but I was just curious, because Elon Musk thinks that there is a high probability that we're all living in a simulation. But I'm very curious what you
have. By the way, I personally, no offense meant here, have a have a theory that Elon Musk is a simulation.
Well, I'm sure he'd be interested to hear that theory.
Well, he's just so flamboyantly wacko and interesting, then how could he be other? And I say that with admiration, okay, not with derogation. So, look, according to Gadgets 360, China this month, December 4th to be specific, China claimed that they have developed a computer that is 10 billion times faster than Google's prototype. This is a quantum computer that Google put forward earlier this year to claim quantum supremacy. According to Google, Google said last year, and I'm quoting here from Gadgets 360, gadgets.ndtv.com, that Google said last year built a computer that can perform a computation in 200 seconds that would take the fastest supercomputers 10,000 years. Now,
this is a little different, though. This is AI. It's not just computational power. It's right. A true artificial intelligence, like the way we think of in the movies, an ultra-smart computer that's thinking. It's actually cognizant. It's aware of itself. But the question is, what would you ask it? What question would you ask?
Yeah, and I very fiendishly, with fiendish cleverness, I turned that around and said, what question would you ask?
And I said, I would ask the same question. Oh, so you would turn it around to the computer, or are you turning it around on me?
I'm turning it around on you, Michael from Portland.
Yeah, and I said, I would ask the same thing Elon did, what's outside the simulation. And now I'm turning it back around on you. What would you ask?
I'm a little stymied there because I don't have any top of mind questions. I suppose I would ask it, what can I do to become the richest and most powerful man in the world? I mean,
that's a great question.
A really good practical question. I would really like to know what I could do.
I like that.
The richest and most powerful man in the world. And so if there was a computer there that was like even smarter than me, hard to imagine, admittedly. But that is your premise. If that was being the case, it would be a little bit like, you know, finding a oil lamp in the sand of the beach by the ocean and rubbing the lamp and asking and discovering a genie comes out and then asking the genie for, you know, to grant one wish. What could be better than being rich and powerful, I ask.
I like that. Yeah, in some ways, I think with AI, we are summoning the genie in a best-case scenario. In a worst-case scenario, we could be summoning the demons.
Well, Elon Musk has been sounding the alarm that AI is going to either exterminate us or enslave us. Now, you have to always give Elon a greater. You always have to take Elon, who is so brilliant that somehow nobody really knows how he escalated into the second richest man in the world after Jeff Bezos this year, even though all he did was, you know, blow up one of his rockets. And decide to, you know, move his car factory from California to Austin and a couple of other things. It's not obvious. Tesla is minute compared to the big automakers, GM, Ford. And yet it has a market capitalization that is bigger than that. I think that, you know, Elon Musk has the most awesome reality distortion field on Earth since Steve Jobs left the building. And I am only grateful that he was born in someplace far away, Australia or New Zealand or something like that. So he can't become the next president of the United States. Because I think that if Donald Trump was weird, Elon Musk.
If Ted Cruz can be president, then darn it, I think Elon Musk should be able to be president. But in answer to your question, why is Elon Musk so rich? It's because Tesla may not make a lot of cars compared to GM, but it's profitable. And it's also a future-leaning technology that I think over the next 15 years or so is going to be replacing the gas-guzzling cars market. And GM wanted to get in on this, so they bought Nikola, which is sort of a knockoff Tesla corporation founded by Trevor Milton, who in my opinion is a bit of a troll. And
I was very taken with around Nikola. 10%.
What?
But apparently it just had its stock price collapsed recently because it turned out that some of the things they were saying that they were saying turned out to be not quite true. And I thought that the founder and CEO got forced out. Isn't that true? This is the hydrogen truck company that I was very charmed by when I encountered about 3 years ago.
Yeah, exactly. This is a hydrogen car company. And GM was like, okay, we've got to compete with Tesla. So they bought into it, only to very quickly find out that many of their claims at least appear to be hyped, inflated, or possibly even fraudulent. So it's really hard to get into future technologies. And when GM, and I don't know if GM is even profitable, tried to do it, they completely bungled it. So it takes a true genius like Elon Musk to sort of have the predictive power to see where the future is going. And he owns the company with the best tech here, both in terms of electric cars and charging infrastructure, and also self-driving capability.
Well, Michael from Maine, the only quibble I have, you're making an astute point. The only quibble I have is I would like to amend what you said. It takes a genius like Elon Musk or Ralph Danko, and then we are in complete sync.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for calling
in. Let me go back and
unfortunately, we're running out. We're kind of quickly running out of time. But do you have a final point to make, Michael from Maine?
Well, we may be summoning the genie, which would be awesome. I think it's more likely that we're summoning the thing that's going to take our jobs, because I think OpenAI has now created something that can write code, it can write articles, it can answer questions. And the first thing that's going to happen is corporations are going to say, hey, we don't need to have all these employees. We can just license this AI. But luckily, Neuralink is hopefully coming out soon, because that is the only way that I think humanity will be able to compete with and avoid enslavement and avoid losing their job to AI. That's my final point.
Yeah, you're wrong. I'm sorry to be blunt about it, but since we're running out of time, I don't have the time to be subtle. Amazon has been...
I appreciate directness.
Amazon has been automating like crazy and hiring more people than it has been automating out of jobs. Amazon now employs 1 million people. And even though they're bringing in robots like crazy into their warehouses and so forth, they are actually generating more and better jobs than they were before they automated. So,
they've also decimated small businesses. So, yeah, sure, they can hire you and pay you $18 or whatever it is to drive a truck. But the person who wanted to sell this thing online or do this small project, those people are all suffering because there's no way to compete.
Well, I happen to be